Hi, I'm Eunice Oladejo, and this is Policy Talks. In this episode, I sit down with John Bell. We discuss the ongoing Israel-Palestine conflict and the atrocities in Gaza. He provides a critical analysis of the conflict's history, its key drivers, the actors involved, and insights on whether there is a path forward to a mediated solution. John Bell has worked for over 30 years on Middle East politics, policy development, and mediation. Amongst many things, today he is director and co-founder of the Conciliators Guild, an organization dedicated to highlighting the critical role of underlying psychological motivations in political decision-making, and to developing a network of excellence in diplomacy and international relations in increasingly difficult times. He is also a former United Nations and Canadian diplomat who served as a political officer at Canada's embassy in Cairo, a member of Canada's delegation to the Refugee Working Group in the peace process of the 1990s, political advisor to the personal representative of the Secretary General of the UN for Southern Lebanon, advisor to the Canadian government during the Iraq crisis, and consultant to International Crisis Group on developments in Jerusalem in 2004. Mr. Bell is also a founding member of the Jerusalem Old City Initiative, an effort to find creative options for this contentious issue. A brief reminder to our followers and listeners that all opinions expressed today are reflective of the individual person expressing them and may not reflect the views of IFRS Canada, the Canadian Foreign Policy Journal, or the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs. Now let's dive into the show. So thank you so much, John, for being here with us today and for taking the time to chat about this really important topic. And just to start us off and do a brief overview of yourself and your work, can you tell us a little bit about your experience within work in the Middle East and then also just generally on the region and what led you to start this work?
Sure. So I'm originally born in the region in Beirut. I'm half Lebanese. We came to Canada in 1968, but I always kept a kind of deep fondness for the region. I was always very attracted to it, its culture. I wanted to go back to live. And I was also, even when I was very young, interested in politics and history, human development, writ large. So all those things kind of combined in me to ultimately go back to do what I did. I had several other careers before that. I was in business. I even thought about becoming a medical doctor. I dropped everything in the end. And by my early 30s, I joined the Canadian Foreign Service with the intent of going to the Middle East. And that's exactly what happened. I kind of felt it in my bones, but my first posting with the Canadian government was to Cairo in Egypt. So my career just went on from there. I was a Canadian diplomat, then a United Nations diplomat, serving in a bit in Gaza, and then in Lebanon, again, on the southern border of Lebanon, northern border of Israel. Ironically, now that I think of it, Gaza and that are the two hot fronts right now. So I've worked on both of those at various times. And then I'm not a very good bureaucrat. I really don't like bureaucracy, and I needed more space and the freedom to operate. So I left and slowly but surely went into the world of what's called Track 2 mediation, which is unofficial diplomacy, informal diplomacy, where we work parallel to official channels and to try to get things done or help the official channels get things done, one of the two. And I've been doing that since 2002 or three, something like that. So now 20 years, now that I think of it, of that, beyond 10 years in official diplomacy, all of it in the Middle East. I've also lived in Jerusalem. I lived again in Beirut as with the UN. I was in Beirut, and I've lived in Jerusalem with Search for Common Ground, the world well-known NGO for conflict resolution. So yeah, I've worked all over it, done many, many different things, know the Middle East well, personally, professionally, culturally. And despite everything, still very fond of it, even though, as I'm sure everybody knows, it's extremely tragic, difficult, and seemingly intractable.
That's a lot of very dynamic and also really extensive work experience that you have. And one of the aspects of your work is that you are one of the founding members of the Jerusalem Old City Initiative. And we'll get more into this a little bit later in the episode, but for someone who may not know much about the initiative or what it is and what the goals are, can you explain its meaning and what were the main aspects or drivers that led to its creation?
So the Jerusalem Old City Initiative is a Canadian-led Track 2 informal initiative to try to find some answers to one of the most difficult issues in the Middle East, which is the Old City of Jerusalem. Now, the Old City of Jerusalem is where the major holy sites are. And above all, there's one holy site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Temple Mount, really almost the same, well, pretty well the same site, depending on how you view these things. And therefore, the Old City contains within it that, plus other important sites of contention between religious national motivations and drives. And so, myself, Michael Bell, no relationship, a former very senior Canadian ambassador, and Mike Malloy, another very senior Canadian diplomat and ambassador. The three of us put our heads together, I think around 2004 or 5, and decided to try to do something on Jerusalem. And we narrowed our focus down to the walled Old City. The walls there are from the time of the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, so 500 years old, a bit older now, I think, 600. And we went to work and we decided to start to plot out what could we contribute that the parties might be able to consider useful, the parties being the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, there are a lot more stakeholders than that in Jerusalem, but those are the two main ones. What might they think are attractive options beyond total control? Because at the moment, as I think everybody knows, Israel controls the Old City completely. And the Palestinians have very little, if any, control over it, except some role in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and other small places in Jerusalem and in the Old City. So our motive was to contribute attractive, useful options. And we worked on it from 2005, at least for 8, 9 years, maybe longer, to be honest with you. I can't even remember how long it took us, but we did a lot of homework. We talked to a lot of people, and we came up with something called a special regime for the Old City. The idea of a special regime for Jerusalem or the Old City is not new. It's been done before. It was even proposed by the United Nations in the late 40s, early 50s. It was then called a corpus separatum that was for all of Jerusalem and beyond. So we did a special regime just for the Old City and introduced, this is the critical piece, introduced third party role in key elements of running the Old City, specifically security and archaeology and heritage issues. There were many other aspects to the Jerusalem Old City Initiative, but those are the main two. And the third party would have to be mandated by the Israelis and the Palestinians. They would agree to it as part of a peace agreement. And the third party would then have responsibility to do X, Y, Z in terms of security for the holy sites, for the Old City in general. This is really important, with the agreement of the Israelis and the Palestinians. We never intended this as a kind of force majeure from on top. But there would have to be a considerable amount of executive capacity for these third parties in order to be effective. In other words, you can't also have them as being sort of a decorative Swiss guard, which in the Vatican, which is just there in a more symbolic, ceremonial capacity. The Old City Special Regime Police Service would actually have to have capacity to act. So that's what we did. We designed it, and books have come out about it, articles. It's relatively well known still to this day. It has a good reputation. So that's what it's about. And who knows? Forms of it may indeed be revived at some point to be seen. It's more difficult now, but we can get into that if you want a bit later.
That was a good overview, and it touched on some of the key elements of this conflict. And I think when things were flaring up again last year, there was a lot of discourse on, okay, what is the actual root of this conflict? It's very, very historical, very protracted, and also very much identity-based for a lot of the components. And so just to talk about the conflict itself, what is, and kind of do like a conflict assessment. You kind of did this, but what is the root of the conflict within the main actors involved? Because I think that with this issue, I think that's a lot of the discourse that is very much debated, and that also then poses the issues of, okay, then what is the actual solution to this conflict?
Well, that's the $6 million question, isn't it? So,
Yeah.
or maybe the 700-year-old question, not $6 million. Look, I'll give you my view on it, and my view is from, it's my view, so it has limits because it's one person speaking, but it does come from interacting with both sides for a very, very long time at every level, professional, diplomatic, and personal. Which is not unimportant. So, I think very tragically, this conflict is a kind of collision. It's a very tragic collision between two different, well, I'm not sure if it had to be or it didn't have to be, but two different forces that were having completely different opposed aims. Okay, one is desire of Jews, mostly in Europe, beginning in the mid-19th century and then going on at the early 20th century, to have a homeland, what's called Zionism. And that effort, which, as many people know, wasn't necessarily at the very beginning is going to be in what was then called Palestine, but ended up in Palestine. There were other options, but it ended up being in Palestine. Came basically head-on collision with Palestinian national ambitions. In other words, and this is, this is kind of a unstated problem, unfortunate problem with the whole Israeli-Palestinian problem, which is always very unfortunate timing. So the Ottomans were ruling most of the Middle East until the end of the First World War. When the Ottomans left, or basically crumbled, the Ottoman Empire fell apart and became fundamentally Turkey. The Brits and the French took over running in the Middle East, large chunks of it, under mandates from the League of Nations. What also happened, very naturally, is Arabs of various ethnicities and nationalities wanted to have states of their own. That's a, it's a natural instinct, motive, identity motive, after having kind of been released from the Ottoman yoke. And in the case of the Palestinians, they naturally also, slowly but surely, from the late 19th century, maybe earlier on, like other Arabs, Lebanese, Syrians, started to develop their own national ambitions. And Zionism came along at pretty well the same time. And for many reasons, including European role, British role, German role in the Second World War, Zionism accelerated and strengthened its position in Palestine. And you had these two clashing nationalities, national projects. I mean, each one. In the minds of the people who belong to it, has its own validity and legitimacy. And that is the fundamental source of the whole problem, is Palestinians wanted to have their own nation and couldn't see why they needed to accommodate people coming from elsewhere. And Zionists believe that Jews should have their own homeland in Palestine because of historical connections and because of what had happened to the Jewish people over centuries in Europe. And those two drives ended up as a contest for land, which lives on to this day. And as we were talking earlier, maybe most symbolically and possibly in the most difficult fashion, a contest over the symbolism of Jerusalem and its control, because Jerusalem is kind of the ultimate totem for both peoples. In fact, throughout history, it's been a symbol of incredible importance to not just Israelis and Palestinians that we see today, but for Muslims, Christians, and Jews throughout history. It's sort of a motherlode, a magnet for what we would now call identity-driven ambitions. I don't think anybody would have called it that even 100 years ago, because it was sort of the norm, is people would pursue their ethnic cultural understandings with vigor and often to dominate and crush another people. So that to me is this unfortunate collision between these two peoples. That's the way I see it anyway. It's tragic, very difficult to resolve. Not impossible, by the way, I don't think it is, but very difficult, yeah. And I must say, everybody knows this, especially I think these days, it's really much more common to say it than 20 years ago. Western powers have done their own contribution to making the situation difficult as well. And it played into it because whether it was Britain in the early part of the 20th century, or Germany's role in the Second World War, or America, the United States since the 50s. It's not just a concern with Israel-Palestine, it's the way these powers were playing their and pursuing their ambitions, whether globally or regionally, ended up feeding into this whole situation, not always in a positive way.
You touched on what I wanted to ask next, but I also am just curious from your perspective, if there really is a route of immediate mediated solution out of this conflict for some kind of resolution, and if there is, and what needs to be considered when we're discussing these solutions?
Well, another $6 million question. Yeah, that is the big question. I think what happened on October 7th has done two things, which are, again, you see, again, with this conflict, you see this, has unveiled two factors that are completely opposed. One, and this is really quite terrible, and I know people on both sides there and in the whole region, so it's, you know, it's been a hell of a time since October 7th. For me, I'm just living in the UK, but for them, it's complete hell. It's unearthed for both peoples, for the Israelis and the Palestinians, for the Palestinians in a much greater scale, but for both, the kind of, let me call it, the existential horrors of both sides. What happened on October 7th and a bit longer on in Israel, when Hamas invaded Israel and committed some pretty horrible acts, is for Israeli Jews, this is one of the worst things that could happen. And I think we have to recognize that moving forward, that the Jewish trauma, which comes from long before that, it's like ripping open the wound. And Israel was created as a haven. And all of a sudden, the haven had been invaded. So you almost can't underestimate to what degree this is traumatic for Israelis and Israeli Jews, and maybe even for Jews outside of Israel as well. So that's one side. And for the Palestinians, it's an absolute horror show. I mean, they're living a horrible war in Gaza, continued occupation in the West Bank. They didn't have normal lives before October 7th, to say the least. And then now, you know, so many deaths, destruction. And if, what I mean by that is, again, it's also reminiscent for them of what happened to them in 1948. You know, the Nakba, the first large dispersal of the Palestinians from their homes. So you have these two traumas unearthed. But at the same time, the opposing positive trajectory, fingers crossed, is all of a sudden what had been written off before October 7th, and is still written off by many people, but not by myself, is the idea of a two-state solution. So people had forgotten about that, or they weren't taking it seriously at all. I'm talking more now about the international community. What we can do, you know, that term is pretty meaningless, but we can discuss what that means. It's the idea that there's an imperative to have two states in order to stabilize the situation between these two peoples is now back on the table. In Israel today, it's not. Not from what I hear, although, I mean, I know a lot of people in Israel, Israelis, who would support it and who think that that is the only answer. But it's, I'm not there, but it sounds to me that the war, October 7th, and just the idea of a Palestinian state beside Israel is at the moment not considered realistic inside Israel. And at the same time, for Palestinians, the notion of a state as they're being, you know, bombarded and crushed in a way is further away than ever. So what could it mean to them? It's also kind of nonsense to them today. But I would say that if one takes a kind of very objective look at it, in the sense that what will really stabilize both people and meet, have their core needs met, I actually don't think there's any way around two states. A form of two states. Now, by the way, I mean, two states is a massive spectrum of possibility there. It's not easy to see which version of two states will ultimately come out and that will be stable. That's a whole discussion. One could have a whole 1 hour podcast just about that. But in my view, it has to, you know, whatever formula is ultimately put forward will have to, again, meet the core needs of the two sides. And they both have many needs, but in the case of Israelis, security is paramount. They have to have a sense that their security is being met. And for Palestinians need to have independence. They can't be controlled by another people or by any other force. Again, those are both natural human motives and needs. So, you know, whatever formula comes out has to meet those needs, among others. The road ahead is going to be very, very challenging. But as I said, you have the traumas unearthed, but you have, at least at the diplomatic level, a sense that there needs to be a drive towards two states. Very difficult, but I suspect, this is my, I guess, my optimistic side, that that drive will take place with unknown results at the moment. And I mean, we can muse all we want about what the outcome will be. We don't know. It's going to take a lot of different ingredients to come into place for it to come about.
And I'm curious, at the moment, what the status of the Old City Initiative is amongst this kind of most recent flare-up, for lack of a better term, and what are the conversations like within the like Track 2 negotiations community when it comes to the possibility of this being an option right now?
Right. So, you know what happens when you get a shock like October 7th and then the terrible war that's happened since then, is the first instinct among many people, this is what shocks do, all historical shocks, is to think, oh, we absolutely have to resolve this. So as the war began and continued and grew in horrible ways, a lot of people started to, even officials, this is not just at the Track 2 level, to think about, well, what in the world can we do to really end this thing? When that thinking starts, then ultimately the idea of Jerusalem will need to be tackled. I don't think there's an answer to these two peoples living together in relative stability without some answer to Jerusalem. But what also happens is, because the war's gone on for a while, and because there aren't that we can't even get to a ceasefire, all the diplomatic energy then either dissipates or goes totally towards, like, what I call the micro immediate, which is, how do you just end the war? So this is a kind of arc of reaction that's quite common. First, you're shocked and you want the solution, and then it drags on and you grow tired, or you realize you need to do step zero before step 100. And now we're really at step zero. But to come to answer your question, very long way to answer your question, I think the work on Jerusalem has to restart, I should say, now. Because it's going to require what we devised 10 years ago needs reformulation for today. So we've already started, and we've kind of put the old team partly together, and we've got new people interested and involved, and we are going to revisit what of the old package is relevant for today forward. What else needs to be done? There's probably a lot more work we didn't touch intentionally because we were careful Canadians, and there's probably stuff that's really sensitive and delicate. Maybe it should never be touched. This is a whole debate about sovereignty, etc. So we are going to restart. We think it's essential to restart because you'll need some good answers available when the issue ultimately comes up. The worst case scenario, by the way, I mean, it's just, sorry for the slight laugh, but because it's just, you know, it's terrible what goes on over there, is the worst case scenario is for all the diplomacy to spend years again dealing with what I'd call the micro issues rather than the core original issues. But there is a kind of tendency to avoid the big stuff, even though it is, like, you know, it's the elephant in the room. But there are many reasons why, especially domestic political considerations in any country, you know, for it's difficult for anybody to make the sacrifices required for peace, anybody. And they'll also be, actually, probably those leaders will probably also be under physical threat from doing so. So it would require quite a degree of vision and bravery, which is easy to say, but it's not common among anyone. You know, we all of us say these things like it's just something you pull off a supermarket shelf. They're not. These are difficult things to incarnate and be and do. So, so we will restart working on Jerusalem. There isn't, I would say, to my knowledge, there isn't any official negotiation, absolutely no official negotiation about Jerusalem today. It's all Gaza. And it's all ceasefire related, hostage release related. And the maximum extra bit is, what does Gaza look like after a war? How do you run Gaza after a war? Nobody has any clue, by the way, not really. Or it's just beginning to be considered now. But we will begin our work on Jerusalem again.
I have to stay tuned to that. And you mentioned kind of moving forward to topics of the UN, and you talked about conversations about ceasefire. And we've seen over the past how many months, ongoing calls that the UN should be demanding a ceasefire. And obviously, we've seen the motion go in, and various countries use their vetoes. But then now we've seen that the UNSC has just passed the motion calling on the ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, which I believe is about 2 more weeks. And so what are the implications of this motion, and does it really hold weight with Israeli leadership?
So, I mean, technically, I'm not a lawyer, but technically, I think all UN Security Council resolutions are international law, de facto. So they do have weight at the legal level. The problem is international law doesn't have weight, period, in a way, if it has no, it has no enforcement mechanism, and also the countries don't take it that seriously, to be quite brutal about it. But there is a benefit to having the P5, especially, you know, the permanent members of the Security Council, agree, or at least one abstained, you know, four agree. Yeah, at least they got to that point. That's a signal. Diplomatically, that is an important signal that that should happen, because those are big countries with weight and leverage, and so that's a good step. I don't think we should just totally ignore it, but you know, that's not how a ceasefire is going to happen. That's not, that's what I'd call, you know, the diplomatic surround, which is important, shouldn't be exaggerated in its importance, nor should it be dismissed outright as totally irrelevant. It's a kind of like creating a fence around which something is done inside. I think in the current, you asked me about Israel domestically, and the ceasefire from the UN Security Council. I don't see any possibility now or in the near future that the Israeli government will listen to anything from the UN Security Council, because it has its own very strong priorities about what it's doing, and which are so beyond a command from the outside that they're not going to listen to it. The only thing that will move the needle is the United States. The United States abstained. The United States actually goes towards voting for and using some of its other leverage on Israel. Unlikely, but you know, then I think that would definitely, even today, if you read the Israeli press today, yesterday, you see automatically that there are beginning to be concerns about the Israeli-American relationship. It's clear. So, you know, what the Israeli Prime Minister does is not wall-to-wall, you know, supported inside Israel at all. So, yeah, I mean, it's and to give it a bit more context, I mean, Israel has its own peculiar sense of, what's the right word, of ensuring its own security, and therefore they'll do anything that they consider necessary. That they've always been like this. This is not new. But ignoring Security Council resolutions is not just an Israeli habit. This is a unfortunate common habit which has made the Security Council far less, I mean, to put it in the most clear terms, if you it makes the Security Council unable to do what its mandate is. It's as straightforward as that, except for certain exceptions, actually. And I think that is the way to look at them, is there have been exceptions since the creation of the UN where Security Council resolutions were implemented. But those are actually exceptions.
Yeah, and you touched on the Israeli-US relationship, and after the motion passed, we saw the Prime Minister Netanyahu, who canceled his delegation's plans to visit the US, which is a pretty strong signal. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts further on the implications that this motion might have when it comes to negotiations or like participating in those diplomatic talks with Israel.
You mean the relationship between America and Israel specifically? Yeah.
Yes. And then also just to add quickly as well, because we've seen the motion obviously is a good signal, and I think what people are calling on now is that this should be a permanent ceasefire motion. And so with that kind of being in possible talks, and then the dynamic of the US-Israel relationship, like how does this affect things?
Sure. So, yeah, no, it's a good question, actually, a good political question. Because it's clear now for at least a month, if not longer. I mean, you know, I'm not, I don't know all the inside stuff going on, but there's a real tug of war going on between the United States and Israel about the nature of the war in Gaza, Rafah specifically, and even over potentially over an Israeli foray into Lebanon in the north. And there is a, it looks to me anyway, that there's an increasingly difficult struggle going on between the two about how to conduct the war, about ceasefires, and about how to end the war. And by the way, even also about what happens after the war in Gaza. So that involves a lot of tactical moves, not strategic, tactical moves by both sides to try to get the other side to do what it wants. And, you know, Netanyahu pulling back his delegation is that. A month and a half ago, the Americans saying, oh, we are going to do some work on recognizing a Palestinian state, is that. Getting David Cameron, or David Cameron saying that we are going to consider recognizing the Palestinian state, is that. These are tactical moves to try to affect the other side, to coerce the other side to do something they don't really want to do. But to link it to the other point, the ceasefire. So the ceasefire is of course, is part of all that, because the Americans are involved in the ceasefire talks directly. They make proposals within them. But the ceasefire is really going to come down to something else, right? Which is how much Israel has to weigh, how much they want hostages back versus how much do they want to give a break to make gaining their military objectives in Gaza. This is not an obvious, if I'm an Israeli leader, that's not an obvious proposition. Because they're contradictory in some ways, you know. So as long as you keep fighting, the more likely it is that the Israeli hostages are going to die, or are dying. That's one. And the other is Hamas's calculations, which are, and it, I think it's pretty clear now, they're seeing that the American pressure on the Israelis is will save them in Rafah, and therefore they ask for more from the Israelis. This is shaking out right now. Here's the point that worries me, though. So, because I think the chances of getting a temporary ceasefire with the release of I don't know how many Israeli hostages and in return X number of Palestinian prisoners, all that may happen. But my concern is the word temporary.
Yeah.
Because that's where we're actually at. I think Hamas's demand for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, which is still their demand, I don't see the, I may be wrong, by the way, but I don't see the Israelis agreeing to that now or any time in the coming months. I don't, because they got themselves into a kind of big military mess in Gaza, and I don't think they've decided what their end game is. That's the bottom line. So a permanent ceasefire will need, it can only happen in kind of two ways. One is, three actually. One is pressure from the outside, which is ongoing, but maybe insufficient. Two is exhaustion, and I don't think we're close to exhaustion. I mean, poor Gazans are exhausted. The civilians, of course, it's terrible, but
yeah.
In terms of the military logic, I don't think we're close to exhaustion, not even close, right? So, and the third is actually having a strategic decision by both parties that this is in our favor and we need to do this now. And I don't think any of those scenarios are there yet, which is why I'm much more likely it's a temporary ceasefire.
And moving on, I guess, to another very big question, but where do we even go from here? And you've talked about a lot of the really very like nuanced dynamics that are at play here. So from your perspective, what are the most pressing next steps that need to be taken in this conflict, whether by the international community at large or by specific stakeholders?
Well, it's actually my hesitation is a reflection of how difficult the situation is and what's been unearthed in this region. Because, sorry to give you a little preamble, then I'll answer your question, right? But because it's actually
No,
not
go ahead.
just about Israel-Palestine. That's the harder aspect. It is also about Iran's ambitions in the region, Iran's interests in the region, and its allies, as we see at Bab al-Mandab with the Houthis, as we saw a bit in Iraq, and as we're still seeing with Hezbollah's role in southern Lebanon and northern Israel. So the picture is broader, I have to say that, than just Israel-Palestine, even though, of course, Israel-Palestine is the core. Now, there is absolutely no way you'll get any serious political moves as long as a war is going on. I mean, that's obvious. Okay, there's no. So you have to end the war. And I don't think anybody knows how to end this war. And that's problem number one. But it has to end, meaning all significant fighting has to end. There will continue to be skirmishes, possibly for a long time, but it has to end. The major now, I think that's exactly what the Americans are trying to do, maybe poorly, but that is what they're trying to do. They're trying to end the war. Okay, so this is my guess. This war may effectively end by, what are we in April, basically now, by June. I mean, it's horrible to say this, but there may be a couple more months. If the war ends in June, effectively, not completely, because it's a complete mess. I mean, we sit and talk about this, but actually on the ground, it's a horror show of urban areas, of people without food, of people without shelter, of soldiers fighting, of insurgency moves against them all at once in the same place. So it's a disentangling that is not something that's done that easily during the fighting. So let's say the most of the violence comes to a general end by the summer. That's fingers crossed, by the way. I think many Israelis say it'll keep going. The next step would have to be, what is Gaza? How do you run Gaza? I mean, even at the level of just getting humanitarian aid in, who's going to do that? Is it the Israeli army? Is it the Palestinians? Which Palestinians? Is it the UN? Well, what's the exact role of the UN? Is it a multinational force? Which one? There are no answers yet. These are all things under consideration. So that would be step number two. Step number three is the most important and could be easily forgotten in the wake of the American elections, of potential Israeli elections, of internal fighting between the Palestinians. And that is a political road to an answer. So we would really kind of have to know who's the next American president. What is the nature of Israeli politics, i.e., is it just going to be this government or something new? And the Palestinians have their own fragmentation to be considered all at once. But there are many diplomatic tracks trying to work at even that, from at least getting the ideas out now to be prepared for that timing. Which, I mean, at my best guess, maybe like next year. Because I think the fall is going to be so soaked up by American elections that anything done is preparatory. But those are the three steps. You have to end the war. Notice I'm not even really saying ceasefire. I'm saying the war has to end. Like they have, because you can't do anything while all the shooting and the killing's going on. Number two is some big decisions about Gaza, which are being worked on, but there are no decisions yet. And finally, a political pathway for both peoples. And we haven't even talked about Iran in that equation.
Thank you for those comments, and very much it very much shows the complexity of this issue. But yeah, I appreciate the response. Kind of moving on to conclude a little bit. You, I believe, co-founded and are currently director of the Conciliators Guild. So I was curious on how the amalgamation or the combination of your different experiences led to the founding, and then also what the aim of the organization is and what some of your work is.
So it actually ties in perfectly. So when I worked on the Middle East for 20, 30 years, I kept noticing that the intractability is kind of linked to one thing. So, and excuse my simplification here, but I think it's a truth, which is that when certain symbolic emotional issues are unmet, and I can tell you what they are, you can forget about a resolution. Forget about it. You can find patchwork answers and pray, but you won't get an answer. So what people call peace, which is really finding arrangements with the enemy, comes about really in three ways. Okay. Either it comes about by military victory of one side so overwhelming over the other that the other is just devastated, and that's it. And that happens throughout history. It can also come about by exhaustion. And people underplay this, but it basically they fight until they can't fight anymore. They don't have resources, energy, etc., and then they stop. I mean, the Lebanese Civil War is actually a perfect example of that. And that doesn't necessarily mean there's a result. There was no result from the Lebanese Civil War. It just means they stopped fighting. The third way is why I set up the Conciliators Guild with colleagues. Is because we don't understand well enough the elephant in the room, which is the real reason behind fighting, which is that humans have certain powerful emotional motivations, including their sense of dignity and status, need for control in life, meaning. If you play with those, like for example, Jerusalem's the ultimate case of this, right? People will kill and die for them. We are not, and this is not just Israel-Palestine or the Middle East, this is the world. We're not sufficiently trained to manage those elements because they're invisible, but at the same time, they're incredibly powerful. We consider them just normal, but they're not normal. They create wars. I could, on another podcast, explain my view that the whole Russia-Ukraine war is mostly that. It's a sense by the Russians of being second class vis-a-vis the Americans and of having their security threatened by Western encroachment. So the Conciliators Guild has two purposes: to get the ideas related to those powerful, basic, innate needs that every human has more part of politics and more well known. One. Two, to see how that goes into practice. And I do that in my own work. I introduce these ideas directly into mediations that I do, etc. And it's not just needs, it's also group behavior patterns. Okay, so we're doing like a seminar next week on mass groupthink, the way we know our minds just kind of shut down and close under certain conditions, and we stop thinking. Well, what are those conditions and what happens to us then? Once that happens, it's too late. So, put it in a nutshell. Can we, the Conciliators Guild, work with a lot of other people to develop a kind of immunity, relative immunity, to these incredibly powerful forces that are built into every single one of us and that go untamed, causing havoc, especially when you have bad leadership that is taking advantage of it, which they can do very easily if they're talented at it? That's what we do.
I had the quote, the bring humanity back to politics, which is one of the aspects, it seems, of the guild. And yeah, I think that's brings together your experiences and is aiming to do something that's really important when it comes to conflict resolution, and then also post-conflict development. But that is all the time that we have today. Thank you so much, John, for taking the time to chat. This was a very good conversation, and I think that you pointed out some really important aspects that need to be considered within this conflict and when it comes to a hopeful resolution. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A big thank you to John Bell for taking the time to have this very important conversation. And thank you to you, our listeners. That's all the time we have today, and we'll see you next time on Policy Talks.